Session number 6229, reel 9.
Mrs. Connie, reel 9.
Yes, well, the guard would count us all out, and we'd go down as many times as they allowed us, sometimes on some days after standing to be counted an hour or so in the sun, and then you'd find when you got down there the water was off. And sometimes it was just a trickle, and it would take about a quarter of an hour to even get about a half a gallon of water. Sometimes it was flowing better. And then when we got back to the gate, sometimes they would direct us not into the camp, into the kitchen, which of course was our first concern, to put the water in the kitchen for cooking. They would direct us to the houses occupied by the Jap officers to fill up their bath tongs, which were erections done in tiles in which they could actually stand. They used to stand in these tile erections, which were about, oh, I suppose 3 or 3.5 feet high, and they would climb into them. And so they took tremendous amount of water to fill up these tongs that we were collecting from down this hill and carrying up in buckets full. I think that annoyed me as much as anything I ever did in that camp, to think that this lovely water, fresh water, was going into their tongs for one man to bath in once, where we had to manage in about a pint of water for bathing in, and then we'd give our pint to somebody else to wash their clothes in or something. And they had gallons and gallons of water that we carried up. If I could dodge that, I used to get up to all sorts of tricks to try and dodge going to them, to their houses. I think in the whole time, quite honestly, I think I only took one bucket ever, because I learned to be very artful about that. Because, as I say, that really infuriated me. And our main concern, as I say, was for the cooking purposes. One day when we came up, the first lot of lettuce we had in the camp, and that was after two and a half years before any lettuce came into the camp. The first time we'd ever heard from home, and these lettuce came in just as we were going down to collect water. And they insisted that we went, and there were lettuce, the first we'd ever had, and we'd got to go down for water. And of course, we were all dying to get back, but we had to go backwards and forwards. And the last time I went down, after having been down 3 or 4 times that morning, the water had stopped flowing. So I had to come back with empty buckets. And there was a guard on who we called Snake, because he was one of the most horrible of them. And he was on duty on the gate when I got back with my empty bucket. So he started shrieking at me because I'd come up with empty buckets. And, of course, I couldn't make him understand, although I tried to point down and shake my head as if to tell him there was no water. And, of course, I thought, oh, he's going to keep me here standing for hours because I've come up with no water. And I was dying to get into the camp to see if there were any lettuce for me. And, however, in the end, he just grunted and let me go in. But they usually used to collect us all outside the gate to count us so that the numbers tallied with the number that went out. And this was rather funny, too, because I don't know why. I can't say Japanese are bad at counting, but certainly the ones we had, obviously, they're not all bad at counting, but we seem to have guards that couldn't count more than two. And they would endeavour to count us, and they used to keep us there hours because they'd count backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. We would count in desperation and say there are so many, but no, they wouldn't take any notice of us. And one day they said that we hadn't got enough, that we were coming back and some were short, some were missing. So some bright spark among the women dived through the barbed wire and pulled a couple of kids out. Kids were playing inside the wire. So she pulled these two children out to stand them in the ranks. And when he counted, we were right. But he saw her doing this, but it didn't matter. Although he'd seen her get these children out from the other side of the wire to make up the number. And then he counted, and that was all right. So we came in. I mean, it was absolute farce because actually the numbers must have been right. Probably somebody had gone in and hadn't come out again for another lot of water and had dropped out. But this guard actually saw these children being pulled out into the line and had to make up the number.
I was quite taken by your observation that you, because you particularly hated filling the tongs up, this was a job you always managed to get out of and contrived some artful dodge of one kind or, and another. And I wondered how, if there was some work that had to be done which you wanted to avoid, how could you avoid it? How could you fool the judge?
Well, it was just a question of making a rough estimate, because you've got to know how many people they would make go into the tongs to fill them up. So that if I saw there were fewer than that in front of me, which would mean that I would be having it, I'd put my bucket down and rub my leg or take my tromper off or something, make some excuse to stop in the trek up the hill, because I'd think, no, if I go in this little group, I shall have to go to the tong, so I'll sort of hang about a bit until more people come up, and then probably by the time, if I wait long enough and go into the queue going back later, they will have filled the tong by that time, and I'll be able to get into the kitchen, you see, or else I'd bustle along with somebody else who'd got, say, two buckets, and he'd be saying like this, and I'd managed to dodge round on the other side and out of sort of a bit out of his eye shot, and managed to get into the, if I hurried, get away towards the kitchen. You know, you thought you get terribly artful, don't you?
Was playing tricks on the Japanese a widely indulged sport then?
Oh yes, I think we all tried it. We all did it if we could, you know. Mm. It was.
Give me some examples.
Oh, I can't think of any.
What were common situations for pulling the wool over the Japs' eyes? Were there any other funny incidences that occurred during this Atup hut period, which we haven't recorded?
Well, I think it was very funny when one of the women was going to have her face slapped, and there was a little guard raging at her and obviously just getting ready to slap her face for some imagined misdemeanour. And she put up her hand as if she was a policeman stopping the traffic. And he fortunately dropped his hand to see why. And she took off her glasses, removed her false teeth, and then stood as if she was ready then for him to slap her face. And he was so taken aback by it that he just grunted and went off and left her without slapping her.
Whilst we're thinking about funny things that happened during the Pelambang period, is there anything in the earlier bungalow period that you may
not have
mentioned?
Yes, well, one night we were just the houses surrounded by barbed wire, so we were fairly near the outside world. And one night the inhabitants of one house were disturbed, and they discovered that one of the women who'd had a suitcase that she had with her, was full of clothes, had been stolen. And so she woke all the women up in her house, and they started shouting for the guard to come, because obviously it was somebody who'd got through the wire from outside and had stolen her very precious case. And not only her clothes, but she had money in it and all sorts of things. And the guard came rushing up, and they tried to explain what had happened. And then, although it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, they turned us all out of our houses and counted us, which struck us as being the last thing that was any good to do, to catch somebody from outside the wire who'd stolen something from inside the wire. And they turned us out and counted us. But that was their only reaction to this woman losing her suitcase. So although we'd got guards on the gate, they couldn't guard our things from being stolen.
Well, we finished the Pelambang period.
Oh, there was one more thing.
Oh, yes.
One of the women, when we were from the houses, people were allowed to go down to the hospital if they had anything seriously the matter with them. And then, of course, we went through the usual counting business, and you were counted when you went down, and you were counted before you left the hospital to come back, because a lot of the visits were just for the day, just to for treatment of some sort. And I happened to be there that day myself. I'd gone down for some reason. And while we were queued up, waiting to be counted to come back, one of the women yawned. And in yawning, she put her hand up to her face. And the Jap on guard immediately rushed up to her and pulled her mouth open by holding her nose and her chin and peered into her mouth to see if she'd put something in her mouth to swallow it. And actually all she'd done was to yawn. And he stood and raved and shouted at her for ages. She had no idea what he was raving about, couldn't make out why he was peering in her mouth. And still storming and raving and face slapping, he then demanded that she took her shoes off. And I made a comment in my diary and said that they must have a very vague idea of the workings of the alimentary canal if they thought that something they thought she'd put in her mouth might appear in her shoes.
Right. Well, let's move on to your next period of internment.
Still going. Oh, you knew it was going to
be. Yes. At what point did you hear about the prospect of a move from Pelembang? Or how did you hear?
Well, I think the senior Jap officer who had charge of the camp just came in and told us that we're going to move sometime. Going to move quickly. We had to move. We had to get ready for a journey. We had to take enough food with us for a journey. And we couldn't take everything with us, but we could take some things with us, and we were to pack up. And, of course, as usual, when they told us these things, it was always very vague as to whether they meant we were going that night, tomorrow, in a week's time, or when it was, but we all started, and we hated moves, but he assured us that it was going to be better for us, and that we would be better off, and so on and so forth. And we did actually go off in three batches, because this was the time when we went from Pelembang back to Muntok. And so, of course, that involved a sea crossing, and we had to go in small boats. And so one lot, as the advance guard, they were asked to volunteer to go because they were supposed to go and get the camp ready for us. So a group of noble volunteers went off first. And we were a bit worried about this. We never liked the idea of splitting up for any reason. We always felt uncomfortable about any splits that were made in the camp. We didn't like the idea of any people being split away from us. But however, this seemed that it had to be done. So they went off first. And the rest of us then, not knowing when we were going, and then they told us to be ready in the morning, which we were. And then we were still there. We didn't know whether we could eat the food we had or not. And they kept us hanging about. And then in the evening they said, yes, you know, you're going in a half an hour. So we all, you know, got ready, got our things assembled and our bundles ready. And then they came back and said, no, we weren't going. And we didn't know whether we could go and lie down and go to sleep or what to do. And then in a half an hour, up came the lorries, and we were pushed into the lorries and taken down to the quayside. And we were put in the dark. We had to embark on these very small boats, and they just pushed us
down.
How
small? How small?
Oh, well, very small. I don't know how to describe them. A boat. They usually describe it in tonnage, and I would have no idea.
Are we talking
about
like
little ferry boats, really?
A small wooden boat with a dozen or so people?
Oh, well, I suppose normally they would have just been little ferry boats. I believe actually one of them was actually one of the ferries that somebody recognised that she had been on previously to go from island to island. One of the little ferry boats that normally plied from island to island, and I think that's the sort of thing they were. And there was a sort of hold, which was, of course, for produce, and some people were pushed down there. And the rest of us just had to crowd on the deck where we could. There was only hardly room to sit. And we were on that all night in the cold. And then we went across, and I think we were left on it a long time in the day as well. And again, we never knew what to do with the food, whether they were going to give us any more, whether we should eat what we brought or what happened. It was always a bit vague. And then eventually we got back to this awful Muntok pier, which we knew and we'd been on before, and we had to stagger along there. And on that journey, the sick people were just laid out on deck in stretchers in the sun. And when we during the day, they were just lying there with their faces up to the sun. It was dreadful. They never seemed to take any special heed for the sick people. And then we got out to the pier, and then they got more lorries and took us to this new camp. And just on inspection, of course, the first party that had gone, the advance party, were already there. And they'd tried to set up the kitchen arrangement somehow. And they'd also prepared a meal for us, because by that time it was evening. And the Japs wouldn't let us have it. They said, no, we weren't to have the meal. We could only have tea. They could give us tea, but we weren't to have the meal. And they'd cooked this meal for us. They'd cooked rice and soup for us. And the Japs said, no, we'd been eating all the time on the boat, and we didn't need the meal. Well, some of them might have been, but most of us certainly hadn't been. So somehow or other, it was very cold by that time in the evening, and we hadn't got the luggage had been brought separately. So we hadn't got anything with us to put on, and we just lay as we were, dirty and tired, and the same sort of arrangement as had been in the huts, even a bit worse, because these were not straight slats. They were like boughs off the trees, almost like branches off the trees put together, so that you lay on slats, as it were. And I didn't have anything. One of the girls who'd got there first gave me her kimono, and that was about all I had. And as I say, we were so tired and dirty and miserable that we slept somehow. And I remember I put in my diary, despite all this, I slept. And it shows that if you're tired enough, you can sleep anywhere.
Mm-hmm. And you'd been interned on Muntok Island before. How did the situation compare with your earlier experience? Well, had the camp changed much, or was it a different place?
Well, it was a different camp. We went when we arrived first, we'd been in the coolie lines, but this was a different camp altogether. And the hutments were quite new, actually. I don't quite know whether they'd been built specially or whether they'd been what they'd been used for. It was different from the one we didn't go back to the same place we were before. And this was very big, and the hutments this time took about 78 of us. We'd only been about 58 or 60 in the other ones. This we were nearly 80 per hut. And it was the same arrangement in four square. And the Dutch went on to one side, and we went on to the other in the same way. We more or less organised ourselves in a similar way from the way we'd been in the hutments in Palembang.
Were the hutments here better or worse?
Well, they were better for the outset. Yes, we thought they were better. The roof was higher, which seemed to be more airy. There were several wells, and they all looked clean. They looked nice wells, and it really at the outset looked rather better. And the kitchen looked as if it was better, and the whole thing, it looked newer altogether. So we thought at first that it was better. And in fact, you know, we were quite pleased with it at first. And it wasn't until, I suppose, gradually a few weeks went by, and then everybody realised that the mosquito problem was terrible. We were all getting terribly badly bitten. And then we started going down with malaria one after another. So obviously the mosquitoes were malarial, and then we started a round of fevers, and this continued until it became, we went there in October, and so after quite a short time, in the month of January that followed, 77 people died, and they were just dying off like flies because these fevers were so virulent. There's different opinions as to what the other fever was. There was malaria, which was recognisable, and there was another fever which some people said was dengue, some people said it was blackwater fever, some people said it was cerebral malaria. Sometimes it was cerebral malaria, which attacks the brain almost immediately, and then people just didn't recover from that. And it really was a very, very unhealthy sight altogether. And although they had said it would be better, and it looked better on the outset. It did turn out to be a terribly unhealthy place. It was dreadfully unhealthy, much worse than the one at Palembang. And so now the deaths really did, I mean, it became frightening the way that people were just literally dying off like flies. And they were bringing up the coffin six at a time and propping them up outside the hospital ward. When they brought the food up, the rations, they'd bring the coffins as well and prop them up outside the back of the ward so that if those people who were in hospital had the uncanny feeling that there was a coffin waiting for them, and it literally was. And there was a terrible outbreaks of diarrhoea, tummy upsets all over the place, and it was really very, very plague-ridden. It was a dreadful place. And as I say, we had anticipated going to a better place and found it was so much worse. And, I can't imagine. I just don't know how many did die. But as I say, I do know it's on record that even in that 1 month, 77 people died, which is a tremendous amount. And it became, every day you just sort of felt like saying, who died during the night? And that's exactly what it was, that the word went round. Oh, so-and-so died during the night, so-and-so died during the night. And they just sort of, every morning there was a death roll told, you know, how many people died tonight, and so many. Then while we were there, they had oil lanterns hung up in every hut, so there was a light on all night. And apparently, I didn't know this, I've read this since in a book, in this recent book, that apparently it's part of the Geneva Convention on the treatment of prisoners that they're supposed to keep the place well lit and airy and all this. Well, the Japs had never bothered about Geneva Conventions before, but apparently this one thing they just nailed on to, and we'd not had this before, but they hung a lantern in every hut. Now, having regard to the fact that these were only just oil lanterns, then came the danger that in all this wood and structure and atap, there was a danger of fire. Because should this lantern fall or be knocked or anything like that, then obviously the place would go up like paper. So then they said that somebody must do fire watching every night. Somebody must be on duty in every hut, every night, to patrol round to make sure that the lantern was safe. And so that really had to be done dormitory by dormitory. Somebody was told in every dormitory, it's your turn. And we just did 2 hours on. So and the person who was on, they started as soon as we went to bed. So the first people would do 2 hours, and then say at 10 o'clock they'd come and rouse the next two, and then those two would do 2 hours, and at 12 o'clock they'd rouse the next two, and so on. And every time I did this, it was my turn. I think probably getting up, it was cold, and we were not supposed to take our rugs or wrap ourselves up, but just to make sure we walked round and round and round to make sure there was no fire. And every time that I did it, I went down with malaria the next day. Weather. Of course, by that time, I was getting malaria every few weeks. And whether the chill of getting up and getting up into the chill brought on an attack, I don't know. But something caused it. And I used to dread it. I used to take my turn because somebody had got to do it all the time. But I knew that the following day, or within 24 hours, I was down with an attack of malaria. It was absolutely fatal as far as I was concerned.
I was thinking as you were talking that with the deaths from malaria being on that high a scale, I wouldn't be surprised if your thoughts were not only who died last night, but how long am I going to last?
Oh, exactly. But it was always, I suppose, at the back of our minds in fact, I mean, I know I'm not perhaps in this camp, but by the time we got to the next camp, because, as I say, I was getting these attacks of malaria every few weeks. And by that time, I was sort of thinking, well, there's only so much the body can stand, and that, you know, if I'm lucky, if the end comes within a few months, I might make it. But if it doesn't come within a few months, I shall never make it. because each attack left you weaker and more liable for the next attack. And it always seemed that if I did anything extra, if I they asked me to go and help with a serving of the rice, whether it was the heat in the kitchen or just the physical effort, I don't know. Then, you see, I'd have to come away. I'd start and be there an hour or two and just stagger away and go flat out with my temperature soaring. Anything that I did that required any effort.
Mm.
And as I say, after these fire-watching efforts, I always had an attack. And as I say, it wasn't only malaria, it was these other fevers and dysentery. Oh, it was... I can't tell you. Everybody went down with something or other.
Did the medical provisions for dealing with this great influx of disease, did they change from what they'd been at...
No, we weren't getting, I think, even less, because while we were in the men's huts, when they closed the access to the hospital in the town, which they closed when we moved to the men's hut, the nuns from that hospital had brought in every available bit of medical supplies they could lay their hands on in the hospital and brought into the camp. So for a time in the men's camp, there was a certain amount of medicines available, certain amount of drugs available, which they had brought from the hospital when it closed down. But now, of course, that supply has been exhausted. And there never seemed to be, well, I think a few quinine tablets would come in occasionally. But among all those people, what could you do? I mean, really, to offset malaria, you need a course of treatment that lasts you about 3 weeks in order to do any good.
Mm.
Well, I remember the doctors would come round with one quinine tablet for the dormitory containing 78 people, probably 20 or 30 of them down with malaria. Well, what could they do with one tablet? And the doctor who was on duty, I remember in our particular ward, she used to take all the temperatures and give it to the one with the highest temperature. And that way I nearly always got the quinine tablet because I managed to run the highest temperature.
Mm.
And I remember she said to me when she gave me this one, she said, well, I'm glad you've got it because you do swallow it. So I said, well, what do the others do? She said, oh, some of them spit it out. She said, they say they can't swallow it. And she said, then it's wasted. She said, at least you swallow it. I said, yes, I'd swallow some more if you could find them. And I remember I was running a very high temperature on New Year's Eve that year. And I used to get, it has the effect, you know, a high temperature has a sort of effect like intoxication. And I was singing at the top of my voice. The bells were ringing, the old year out and the new year in, and all sorts of things, Auld Lang Syne, and I was singing this, and everybody was trying to get to sleep, and they were coming to try and shut me up, and I went on singing, and just as if I can remember the exhilaration of this feeling, and of course my temperature was way up, and it was marvellous. I was floating on the clouds, and I knew I was conscious of the fact they were telling me to stop, and yet I couldn't stop. You know, I was just as if I was drunk. You know, just like a drunk who you say to them, "Be quiet," and what do? They just go on making the same noise, and I just went on, and it didn't matter how they told me to stop. I just went on singing.
Now it's evident this area you moved to at Muntoc was quite unsuitable for an internment camp, and I imagine that Mrs. Hinch and the Dutch commandant probably made some overtures to the Japanese about where you'd been put. Would this be right?
Oh, yes. They were always doing what they could. The Dutch commandant was the Reverend Mother and a very able Dutch assistant who did most of the active work, because she could, actually, she could speak Japanese, but she never quite let on. She never let them know she could, although she could understand what they said, which was very useful. And she could speak the Javanese language for the Indonesians, and so she was very useful in that way. Then they were always making overtures to the Japs to get us in medical supplies, because this was the great thing that we needed. As far as the hutments were concerned, we still had somebody in each hutment who was mainly supposed to be the sort of captain of the hut, who, if Mrs. Hinch, we'll say, realised that we, like the fire watching, needed that something would have to be organised, then she would get this person who had been elected the captain of each hut. Oh, well, will you see that there are two people in your hut told to do this every night and so on. And but, of course, as I say, the sickness was the thing that was utmost in our mind in this camp. And apart from the nurses giving up everything else for their nursing and so on, there wasn't, you know, I wasn't aware much of organisation. The things went on, the camp was kept clean by the people who were still on their feet. And it really came to that sometimes. The people would come round to the huts and say, is there anybody still on their feet who could do so and so? And this was it, you know. Could somebody still on their feet do something or other? Or would somebody still on their feet come and help with something or other? It was as bad as that.
And this in turn must have led to the further deterioration of conditions, that there were less and less people able to look after things.
Yes, there were fewer people who were able. And then if they did too much, obviously they were undermining their strength as well. It was a vicious circle, really. Mm. If you were on your feet and tried to do something, you probably found that you weren't on your feet after a few days of trying to do something.